all this talk these days about the Russians developing this new missile or us doing this or that. And the idea is that it's going to give us an advantage. That's not going to happen. We live in a mad world. There's no way either side can develop the capability to achieve a splendid first strike. That's where you take out the other side's assured destruction capability. Nevertheless, both sides are going to continue to talk about how dangerous it is when the other side develops a new weapon or the other side tests its nuclear arsenal. But in the final analysis, it just doesn't matter. If you're going to use nuclear weapons, the only way you can use them is in a limited way and then hope that you don't get escalation. But the idea that you can attack the other side and achieve a splendid first strike is not realizable. There are just too many warheads. If you have 1,000 warheads and you get 98% of the other side's warheads, which is extremely unlikely. We used to run these exercises during the Cold War. If you get 98% of the other side's 1,000 warheads, strategic nuclear warheads, there's still going to be plenty of warheads left to turn your society into a smoking, radiating ruin. And then when you throw in things like nuclear winter and so forth and so on, it's just hard to see how anybody can win a nuclear war. Nevertheless, we're going to continue to talk about that. We're going to continue to talk about the advantages of underground tests of nuclear warheads as if this mattered. But I'm happy to say it doesn't matter because, again, we live in a mad world.
The Russians, one of the other things they've been talking about here is that this obsession, I think, is the only kind way you can put it, that the West has with using sanctions, which you mentioned a minute ago, to try to bring Russia to their knees. And Putin also talked recently about how that's a fool's errand.
Now, regarding the new sanctions, first of all, there is nothing new here. Yes, of course, they are serious for us. That is clear. And they will have certain consequences. But they will not significantly affect our economic well-being.
President Putin basically said today that Russia is immune from U.S. sanctions. He said that it would not impact the Russian economy in any serious way. Is he
good.
Wrong?
I'm glad he feels that way. That's good. I'll let you know about it in 6 months from now. Okay, let's see how it all works out.
Yeah, about that 6 months. I'm not sure that that's an anniversary he's going to want to go back to. What do you say?
I think Trump understands that the sanctions are not going to work. I think he's just going through the motions here. There's no evidence that the administration is working overtime to make the sanctions work. Almost everybody agrees that this new set of sanctions that the administration put forth are going to work at all. You have to really work overtime to make them work. And we're not doing that. And even if we did, it's not going to matter very much. It's not going to affect what happens on the battlefield. It's not going to affect what's happening in terms of trade flows between China and Russia or between India and Russia. So they can talk about sanctions forever and ever, but it's just not going to do much. And again, I think Trump fully understands this. We have no cards to play, Danny. You and I have talked about this many times. Where's the Tomahawk missile these days? You hear anybody talking about the Tomahawk these days? The magic weapon that was going to turn everything around, rescue the situation? No, nobody's talking about it. Because basically everybody knows that the Tomahawk was not the magic weapon that was going to win the war for the Ukrainians, no matter how many we gave them. It might have made Russia's task a bit more difficult, but not very much at all. And the same thing is true with sanctions. If there was any magic formula for winning this war, Joe Biden, who was deeply committed to it, would have figured it out. A year ago today, Joe Biden was still in power. He couldn't find the magic formula. How is it that Donald Trump's going to be able to find the magic formula?
Well, and the reason I use the term obsessed is because whatever Trump may know, and that was, I think, on the 20-something, 26th of October, somewhere around there, about how they laughed and, ha, 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 well, we'll see him in 6 months. That was last month. Okay, this is 2 days ago where there was a Zoom call between Volodymyr Zelensky and a number of U.S. senators, and watch how gleefully they're looking to go from the 19th sanction package that haven't worked. They're looking, by the way, in Europe to do the 20th. They're getting ready for that right now. And then apparently, on top of what the U.S. did back in October, these senators are looking to do another one after that.
What I'd like to know on the military front is, besides the Tomahawks, where can we be most helpful? Because I know continued military aid is very important, whether it's the Patriot missile interceptors or other weapon systems that would be helpful to you.
I wanted to first thank you for your leadership. Thank the Ukrainian people for their courage. I don't have a question, but I wanted to let you know, I know the ambassador is following this very closely. In the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Risch, who couldn't join us today, is the chair. I'm the ranking member. But we have put forward the first three bills out of the committee to address, to go after Russia because of their actions.
Thank you for your leadership on this. And Gene, the same. Mr. President, you've got just amazing group of champions of Ukraine here on the Zoom. It's good to see you again.
The rest of the year and beginning of 26, we're going to go all in, giving you military capability to hurt the Putin war machine even more. And we're going to try to isolate Putin even stronger than we have today. If we can pass this bill, making Russia a state sponsor of terrorism under U.S. law, that makes his economy radioactive.
Right.
Amen.
Amen, he says there. And you talked about mad world or an irradiated smoking ruin. I mean, you have you have Lindsey Graham there trying to talk about an economy that's irradiated. Even though 20 rounds of these things haven't worked so far, they somehow think it's going to work again. And you said right before we went on here, you know, mocking basically, who thinks about the Tomahawk anymore? And you see, the U.S. senator does right there. Well, other than that, how can these things work? And then, to me, this is one of the, of all the things that I've shown you today, this is one of the most alarming to me, because these are key senators from both parties that are still talking at nearing the 4-year mark of this war, when everything has failed utterly to change the dynamic on the battlefield that you keep mentioning, and they still are talking like the next one will make a difference. How do you react to that?
These people are delusional. I mean, it's not worth having a serious conversation about this. I mean, what can you say? I have a more important issue to talk about. The fact is that Ukraine needs about $100 billion a year to sustain itself economically, about $100 billion a year. And the Europeans are trying to find $200 billion so that they can fund Ukraine for the next 2 years. And the problem that the Europeans face is the Americans have basically opted out of funding Ukraine. And President Trump has told the Europeans they have to do it, which is why they have to find $200 billion. Well, these are all countries that are in significant economic trouble. So the question is, where are they going to get $200 billion? And what they're thinking of doing is stealing it from those frozen Russian assets in Belgium. But the problem is they can't get the Belgiques or a handful of other countries, the Italians and the French, and even the European Central Bank, to go along with this idea, because they think it may boomerang and do enormous damage to each of them. So it looks like there's no way they're going to be able to steal these Russian frozen assets and come up with $200 billion. So the question you want to ask yourself is, put aside this nonsense about sanctions, what are the Ukrainians going to do if they don't get the full $200 billion? So when you and I talk about the situation on the battlefield, just think about what you were saying about how things are going on the battlefield. Just think about the bombing campaign that's now taking place against infrastructure in Ukraine, which we haven't talked about. Think about the fact that Trump is basically pulling out, and that the Europeans can't come up with $200 billion. When you take all of those factors together, and you contrast them with what these senators were saying, you just say to yourself, is this the real world? Am I hearing these people correctly? I mean, we've reached the point in the West where it's just hard to take most of our policymakers seriously.
You know, there was a, I think it was yesterday, there was a press conference with Marco Rubio. He was talking about a whole range of different issues, one of which was on the Russia-Ukraine war. In his comments, he made kind of an offhanded comment while he was talking about something else, which really got my radar antenna firing up, because I'm like, wait, he just said out loud what we all know, and it seems to have been missed by most people. He was talking about, let's keep giving Ukraine all this stuff, and the bombing campaign that you mentioned here about how devastating it's going to be, and how, well, we need to get them some air defense interceptors, whatever, to try to protect their infrastructure. And then he makes an interesting admission on the backside. See if you catch it.
We've had those conversations with the Ukrainians about what they need, and I know that's ongoing. And, you know, clearly helping them survive the winter is important just from on a humanitarian ground. The challenge is that Ukraine's energy grid has been diminished each year. So each year they start at a lower baseline than the year before. Now, I think in Kyiv, for example, upwards of 50 to 60% of the day is spent without electrical power. And they've done a tremendous job of sort of rerouting their grid and trying to work around it. But that also means there are hours of the day where you can't. There's no water. There's no electricity. You have to schedule business and life activities around that. And that's clearly part of Russia's strategy, is to try to collapse morale within the Ukraine and the will to fight. So, you know, that's why we've been in discussions with them about defensive weapons to be able to protect their grid. And I know we've been in ongoing technical conversations about the specific equipment they need. But ultimately, if that equipment is ultimately destroyed a week later after it's installed, that remains a problem. And that's been the history of the last.
It remains a problem. If a week later what we give you is destroyed, then make that make sense to me.
You know, that was sort of the new Marco Rubio. He really sounded smart and reasonable. He was describing the problem, and he was also explaining why it can't be fixed. And of course, what you want to then do is take what Rubio said and put it together with what's happening on the battlefield and what's happening with regard to that $200 billion that they need. And the fact that Tomahawks and sanctions are not a war-winning set of weapons, and figure out how that all adds up. What does that all add up to? And as you and I have been saying ad nauseum for God knows how long, the Ukrainians are doomed. And we would have put an end to this war as quickly as possible so that Ukraine loses as little territory as possible, number one, and so that more Ukrainians do not die. Our viewpoint, Danny Davis's and John Mearsheimer's viewpoint, is occupying the moral high ground, right? All these people who think that they are pursuing the morally correct strategy by encouraging the Ukrainians to continue this fight are wrong. The smart thing to do from a moral point of view and a strategic point of view, I want to emphasize that, from a moral point of view and a strategic point of view, is to listen to you and to listen to me and to end this war. Nobody, as Marco Rubio made very clear, can come up with a way to turn this one around.
And in fact, we're not even at the zenith yet. On top of everything that you just said, in all those categories, which I won't repeat at all, but we'll add to it, Russia is in the process now of accelerating its production of missiles, strategic drones, and rockets to the tune of tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of armored vehicles, tens of thousands of additional armored vehicles, and repairing whatever. They're building up their stockpiles, millions of tactical drones, multiple millions of artillery shells. In addition to what they use on the battlefield, they're still having these big stockpiles. So for the, I mean, way distant future, they're never going to run short of any of those things, which are causing all the damage that Rubio was talking about in there. Meanwhile, on our side, we're still only producing about 600 interceptors a year. We're about one third of the artillery production. The EU continues to ramp up, but they won't even have their military if everything works in their economies to allow them to get up to 3.5% of actual military production by 2030. They'll still be behind what the Russians are because they're not slowing down. We showed some satellite imagery where they have massive, massive on the Russian side factories being built right now for military industrial. So they still haven't slowed down the increase. Given all that, I'm going to ask you a question you've really just answered. Where is the morality and the rational and the strategic willingness to go down a path that literally cannot succeed, yet we're doing it with those senators just showed you just 2 days ago gleefully talking about leadership and all this stuff? How does all that fit together?
Well, as I said to you, it's delusional. By the way, we left out another key element in the story, which makes it even look bleaker for the Ukrainians. And it goes like this. Russia basically has one concern at this point in time, and that's the war in Ukraine. The United States has two other concerns besides the war in Ukraine. One is the Middle East, and two is East Asia. And East Asia really matters. We have this whole concept in our strategy called the pivot to Asia. The reason we have a pivot to Asia is because we consider China to be the principal threat to the United States. China is a peer competitor. Russia is not. So there's powerful pressure on us to build up our military forces in East Asia. And furthermore, there's powerful pressure on us, mainly of a domestic political sort associated with the Israel lobby, to support Israel and its many wars in the Middle East. So we're pulled in three different directions. Putin is not pulled in three different directions. Putin can concentrate on the war in Ukraine. He can focus laser-like on that. And as I said before, if you look at what President Trump is doing, he's basically trying to wash his hands of Ukraine. He's shifting the burden for handling the Ukraine portfolio, so to speak, over to the Europeans. And the Europeans are in no position to handle Ukraine without American help, to handle Ukraine by themselves. So if you look at the grand strategic picture and the situation that the United States faces versus the situation that Russia faces, this is just another example why the Russians are going to prevail. Although I want to qualify that by saying they're not going to win a decisive victory. And as I said before, I don't think they're going to get regime change. I think you're going to end up with an ugly victory, or to put it in slightly different terms, a frozen conflict in an environment that is poisonous to the core and where the potential for big trouble moving forward is very great. And again, this gets back to that whole story that you showed where the Russians are trying to get their kids in grade school militarized. They want them thinking strategically. They want them to understand that Russia lives in a threat environment. That's because the Russians understand that this conflict with the West is going to go on for a long time. And Danny, if I can make one final point on this, you want to remember that now that Finland is in NATO, the Russians have to worry about their border with Finland. And they are doing things to reinforce that border because that is a border with an important NATO state. So when you think about what's going on here, the potential for more and more trouble down the road is endless.
It certainly is. And when you say that your Russians will win an ugly victory, but not a complete destruction of the state of Ukraine, I think we've talked in the past that you say basically up to the Dnieper River to include Odessa, maybe in the south, and Kharkiv in the north. I mean, what do you consider the limit of advance?
I take about 40% if I were in Putin's shoes, right? I mean, again, it's worth repeating this, even though you and I have talked about it many times. Because the West is unwilling to accommodate the Russians in any way, And the West is still interested in wrecking Russia as a great power. The Russians, therefore, have a vested interest in taking as much territory as possible and making the remaining Ukrainian state, the Ukrainian rump state that's left over, as weak as possible. So number one, it's not much of a threat to Russia. But number two, it's not in a position where it can join NATO and the EU. So that incentivizes the Russians, I think, to take about 40% of Ukraine. And I think they'll take everything up to the Dnieper River in the northern half of Ukraine. And then down south, they'll cross the Dnieper. They have to if they're going to take all of Kherson, which they've annexed. And I wouldn't be surprised if they went into Odessa and one or two other oblasts as well. I think taking Odessa would make eminently good sense from their point of view. And again, let's just reemphasize that this is why you and I have long argued that the Ukrainians should cut a deal now and accommodate the Russians as much as possible so that they don't lose that territory. Don't give the Russians an incentive to take Odessa. But in fact, what's going on here is you and I have said ad nauseum is that our policy, the Europeans' policy especially, and Ukraine's policy is incentivizing the Russians to take more territory. So I wouldn't be surprised if they take about 40%. And by the way, Danny, this is another whole subject. When they take more territory, even the territory that they've now annexed, there are going to be a lot of people left in those territories who are sympathetic to Ukraine and are hostile to Russia. And of course, the Ukrainians and the Europeans will go to great lengths to sabotage Russian efforts inside of the areas that they annex. And this will lead to significant ethnic cleansing. The Russians will have a very powerful incentive to drive ethnic Ukrainians or anybody who appears to be sympathetic to Ukraine or to the West out of the annexed territories. And at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if there's significant ethnic cleansing in the other direction. All of this just points out what a total disaster this whole situation is.
It does.